Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I'm Nate Walker, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Religious Freedom Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C. In this program, we'll be exploring religious liberty and religious literacy in American public schools, looking at different frames and different approaches in order to look at how the public school has historically been a locus for some of the great battleground issues on religious liberty. And so, for those of you who have been to the Newseum, you'll recognize the First Amendment etched in stone in the front of the building. The building located in between the White House and the Capitol on the nation's main street, right across the street from the Smithsonian's. Our mission is to promote religious liberty for people of all religions and none. We educate people about the First Amendment principles. We also pride ourselves in being nonpartisan and nonsectarian, in that we bring together people who normally would sue one another and yet find common ground. And that legacy is made possible by the founding director of the Religious Freedom Center, Dr. Charles Haynes. Many of you may know his work. He's published in many, many different areas, including the landmark publication, Finding Common Ground, which consists of many consensus statements, several of which are republished in your booklets today. So you'll see those religious freedom pamphlets. And that's in part made possible by Dr. Haynes. He would convene people on very divisive topics to seek to find some common ground on these key issues. They range from Bible in public schools to workplace issues to all kinds of issues about religion in public life and in public schools. So our mission is to promote the religious liberty principles within the First Amendment. We envision a world where religious liberty is true for all people everywhere in the world, but we recognize that there is a fundamental problem that we are facing in the United States and around the world, and that is many people are not trained about these principles, and that results in legal illiteracy. And also, people are often not trained about religion in general, which can result in illiteracy and stereotyping, can result in increased social hostilities as a result of these conflicts over religion and public life. So our plan is to address that by doing what the Newseum does best, and that is to educate about the First Amendment. We do this by promoting civil dialogue, bringing together people to have civil conversations. We equip schools to be able, for their leaders to be able to negotiate these conflicts with skill. We engage the public by offering different events, and we advance scholarship by hosting fellows and researchers to produce new material. And we do all of these things in light of our education initiative, which is to provide full online programs that are accredited by any one of our partner institutions. Right now we're serving 7 theological schools and colleges and universities that offer graduate credit for what we teach online. Then the students come to the Newseum for an on-site program where we then blend the distance education with the abroad program like model, and they get that transformative experience of being with national experts in Washington, D.C. We pride ourselves in creating a very interactive model where students can watch, interact, read, discuss, write, and then present to one another. We have video conferencing that brings together our students from 15 different states. Our students represent 25 different religious identities this last year alone, and 61% of whom are people of color. So this has brought together a very diverse group of people who are studying the principles of religious liberty. There are three competencies that we seek to promote across this curricula. One is religious literacy, one is legal literacy, and the other is civil dialogue. And these three things will make up the themes of today's conversation. Some guiding questions as we go through our time together. First is, why promote these three civic competencies in American education? And why begin with civil dialogue? And what is civil dialogue and what is it not? How is it taught? What is religious literacy? How is it achieved? And why have some of our faculty identified this as a prerequisite for religious liberty education? And then finally, within theme with this entire conference, what is legal literacy about religious freedom? What are the constitutional and human rights principles that guide us? What are the limits of the law? So let's start with this first question. Why American education? There are many different reasons why. I can think of three offhand. One, public schools have been the primary locus for religious liberty battles. Many leaders, from principals, school board members, to teachers, feel unequipped to address those issues and often avoid them altogether, as if conflict avoidance is a civic strategy. Many learners will go through their entire education without understanding both the law or religion in public life. And this is all happening in a tremendously dynamic, changing landscape. The religious demographics alone in the United States are changing so dramatically that public schools are finding that who they are teaching in the classroom are often much more diverse than society at large. And so there, many schools are trying to navigate those complexities. So as we know from the issues about the locus, is that the public school has often been the place where there have been legal conflicts over the Bible, evolution, graduation, holidays, pledge, prayer, religious clubs, religious garb, and so on and so on. This is just a few of the 500,083 million conflicts that have occurred. We're seeing that many public schools, their leaders will come to us, they'll call and ask, how do we deal with this particular issue? Where can I get trained in order to be a leader in my school? Where can I go to help my school become a First Amendment school that protects religious liberty in the school? And what are the consequences if we as leaders in the schools don't get that training? And so we're seeing lots of different conflicts occur over lack of understanding and so on. There was a recent study, for instance, that showed that one in four Muslim families have had kids who have experienced bullying in the public classroom. And then out of that, you have seen that one in five of those acts of bullying have come from teachers or school administrators themselves. And so you're beginning to see multiple layers of these conflicts. So the question is, if the school is a public school, is it equipped to serve the entire public? What we're seeing with the change of the demographics in the U.S. is quite extreme. In 2012, Protestants, for the first time in U.S. history, became a minority. This is a fundamental shift that has many different reasons, some of which we'll be exploring in a little bit, much of which have been explored in other sessions. But how I interpret these changes to mean is that we, if not now, will soon become a nation of religious minorities, where we as a country will have the responsibility and the challenge of doing what no other known government has ever had to address. And that is, how do you govern without a majority? And so clearly you can, when you add Catholics with Protestants, you'll see that there is still 70% of the U.S. population that identify as Christian. But the diversity within Christianity is so complex that there are often divides, and the changing dynamic of the many different Christianities in America is seen on the front pages every week nowadays, specifically changing on social issues and political issues and so on. So what does it mean to train the next generation of students to govern a nation of religious minorities? One of the most unique challenges before any other generation. So, given that context, our goal at the Religious Freedom Center is to help educators and education leaders see their school and to train their communities to see their schools as laboratories for democratic freedom, where we can move beyond the public school being a place of a battleground to a place to find common ground, where literate leaders, both legally and religiously, will be able to have the complexity and have the sophisticated understanding in order to address the concerns of the students, the parents, community groups, and the public at large. You'll then have an entire generation of students becoming not only legally literate, but religiously literate about issues of religion and public life. And the larger social context, the dramatic changes of this nation of religious minorities require one thing of all of us, and that is to seek mutual understanding. And understanding need not imply agreement. And so a lot of our work is about seeking that mutual understanding as a prerequisite for finding common ground, which leads us to ask, why start with civil dialogue as a core civic competency when doing this work? And I think it's really, the answer is quite simple, and I think you can all say it together. Why not? There's an incredible amount of hostility around issues of religion in public life. There's an incredible amount of stereotyping that goes on about the nature of religion and the motives of people. And I think we can de-escalate those things by engaging in an ethic of civil dialogue. So I'm going to go through some of the various ways that our faculty seek to use civil dialogue training in legal education. If you would like to have copies of these slides, I'd be happy to receive your card afterwards so you can refer to any of this later. The first thing we use in order to promote civil dialogue is the Williamsburg Charter, which was signed by 100 national leaders in 1988 in commemoration of the 200th anniversary of Virginia's call for the Bill of Rights. In this document, these leaders articulate the three R's of religious liberty: rights, responsibilities, and respect. Meaning everybody has rights, everybody has the responsibility to protect those rights of others, in particular of those with whom they disagree, and it must be done in a respectful way. These three R's of religious liberty have guided the faculty in creating pedagogies for using the curriculum itself as laboratories for democratic freedom. So in this video, you're going to hear from a few of the people at the museum, and we just pulled them together in the studio and said, hey, will you read this out loud? This is really great text. And so these are some of my colleagues who've worked at the museum.
Religious freedom, liberty of conscience,
is a precious, fundamental, and inalienable right
for people of all religions and none. central to the notion of the common good.
And greater importance each day.
Because of the increase of pluralism.
Is the recognition that religious freedom is a universal right.
Joined to a universal duty to respect that right for others.
Rights are best guarded.
And responsibilities best exercised.
When each person and group guard for all others.
Those rights they wish guarded for themselves.
Conflict and debate are vital to democracy.
Yet if controversies about religion and public life
are to reflect the highest wisdom of the First Amendment
and advance the best interests
of the disputants and the nation,
then how we debate,
not only what we debate,
is critical.
These statements have been a profound influence on us as people who convene, people who normally are at opposite sides of the political spectrum. But when we start here, specifically when Dr. Charles Haynes would go into public schools that were embroiled with conflict, he would ask them if this rings true to them, if they can affirm that everybody has the right to religious freedom, that everybody has the responsibility to protect the rights of others and to do that respectfully. When he does that work, he's found over and over and over from negotiating conflicts with schools all around the country that this is a framework that, in my own words, tone down the crazy, right? It brings people to a space where there's more oxygen in the room, and it gives them a chance to see themselves in some common purpose in these common schools. One of the other frames that one of my colleagues, the Reverend Kristen Looney, who's an Episcopal priest, has been using in training our students is the essence of dialogue. This is a document used by the Tony Blair Faith Foundation in their program called Generation Global, previously known as Face to Faith. And in this document, they talk about how dialogue is an encounter with difference. It's a process of seeking understanding. It's not debate. Dialogue is not mediation. Dialogue is not conflict resolution. It's a kind of leaning in and feeling a sense of that uncomfortability with that encounter, aware that mutual understanding need not imply agreement. In this context, we also draw upon the writings of Diana Eck, who talks about pluralism. Pluralism is not only the evidence of diversity, it's the energetic engagement with difference. Pluralism is not just tolerance, but the active seeking of understanding across lines of difference. Pluralism is not relativism, but the encounter of commitments. And you need not leave those commitments at the schoolhouse gate. Pluralism is based on dialogue and encounter and opportunity to give and take criticism and self-criticism. Another tool that I've been using to help people engage in civil dialogue on religious liberty issues is to understand what Robert Schreider calls seven ways to distinguish the other. We can demonize the other, treating someone to be feared and eliminated if possible. We can, on the other hand, romanticize the other, treating the other as far superior to ourselves. We can colonize the other, treating the other as inferior. We can generalize the other, treating the other as a non-individual. We can trivialize the other by ignoring what makes the other disturbingly different. We can hegemonize the other by claiming that their reality has no difference. We can vaporize the other by refusing to acknowledge the presence of someone else at all. In our civil dialogue programs, we use this in order to give people the tools for listening in the midst of dialogue, primarily to listen to oneself and asking, am I otherizing somebody? When we work with educators, we draw upon the writings of Robert Coles and The Call of Stories, where teachers talk about their use of the moral imagination in the classroom. The moral imagination is that ability to anticipate or project oneself into a middle of a moral dilemma and understand all the points of view. So they use that as a pedagogical tool in their classrooms, but they also use it as a type of professional development for their own work. I use the moral imagination in training religious leaders in theological schools and how they might use the moral imagination as an everyday spiritual practice so that they may cultivate empathy for those they were taught to demonize. And in this conversation, what we're ultimately trying to do is create a culture, a climate at the museum, a relational framework where we can move from marginality to mattering so that everyone present knows that they matter, knows that they belong, and that they will be heard. And in doing so, we seek to move beyond the inferiority complexes that we begin to see play out in society, the superiority complexes that lead people to justify harm to others. And that shift from marginality to mattering again brings oxygen to the space. And imagine if we were to create that kind of holding ground for public schools to do that with all of the public it serves. It's in this context we ask, why is it so essential to promote religious literacy as a fundamental civic competency? And how can it be a prerequisite for religious liberty? So we turn to the guidelines articulated by the American Academy of Religion that teachers use to understand about the constitutional and religious studies frameworks for teaching about religion in public schools. And they offer three premises. The first is that there is a widespread illiteracy about religion in the United States. Mormons have experienced that for many generations of stereotypes of being otherized by the general public and by people in power. That illiteracy is also being experienced by other different groups in the United States as well. And so an illiteracy, the American Academy of Religion defines as the lack of understanding about the basic tenets of the world's religions and other religious expressions not categorized by traditions. It's also a lack of understanding about the diversity of expressions and beliefs within traditions and the profound role that religion plays in human, social, cultural, and political life, both historically and today. And so it's in this context we draw upon the writings of the scholars at the American Academy of Religion to articulate religious literacy as the ability to discern and analyze the intersections of religion with various cultural, social, and political aspects. And so that being the first premise, that there is illiteracy, they also make the premise that illiteracy can cause incredible amount of harm. It can fuel prejudice and antagonism. And to have that be a culture in a public school where you're often compelled to attend if you don't have a private option, it can create a very hostile learning environment that can really stunt people's civic education. I think it is happening in the United States quite a bit. A lot of prejudice and antagonism about people. For instance, people of faith articulating their religious view being shut down and told they cannot speak. People of minority religious traditions articulating a view or wearing a certain type of religious dress, for instance, being marginalized and asked to leave. There are many instances of this that can cause children harm, as well as teachers, as we'll see in just a minute. The third premise that they offer is that to diminish religious illiteracy, we must have a civic approach to teaching about religions in public schools. And so in this context, the American Academy of Religion draws upon much of the consensus guidelines that Charles Haynes helped develop along with a coalition of broad, ideologically diverse groups in articulating the difference between devotional education and civic education, and how and why it's important to understand that distinction when talking about religion in public schools. I served congregations for 14 years, and one of my greatest privileges was to be in the presence of children and youth and young adult who were going through faith formation. Faith formation, where they were being able to articulate their beliefs, being supported by the community, understanding their part and how they belong in that larger tradition. Going to seminary was a further extension of that, and I love theological inquiry, and I love how transformative it can be. But as a religious leader, I understand the consequences of taking a devotional approach in a public place where people of other faith or of no faith are compelled to learn. And so it's in this context I affirm the civic education approach that many of these civic and religious leaders from around the country have been advocating for, and you can learn more about this in your pamphlets. That's right, there is no compulsion. And not only is that not only a theological principle, as you articulated early, it's a civic principle. And so what's beautiful about this approach is that it's preparing students to engage in their future in college, in their careers, and in civic life. And so it's an academic study of religion that's distinct from devotional. For instance, in this statement, you'll see, I believe it's 21 different religious liberty groups who are from a wide range of perspectives agree on this statement. That was also published by the Department of Education and distributed to the public schools around the country. And that is, the public school's approach to religion is academic, not devotional. The school strives for student awareness of religions, but does not press for student acceptance of any religion. The school sponsors study about religion, not the practice of religion. The school may expose students to a diversity of religious views, but may not impose any particular view. The school educates about all religions. It does not promote or denigrate religion. The school informs students about various beliefs. It does not seek to conform students to any particular belief. Absolutely. I think as school systems, many schools do uphold this, but often there are individuals, some teachers, some parents, and so on, who don't agree with these things, and they may be motivated to engage in devotional type of work. And so those often turn into litigation and before the courts, and it can be really quite messy. So a lot of what we're trying to do is to do the cultural type of civic education that can prevent those legal conflicts in the future. So one of the ways we do that is we have worked with the American Academy of Religion and the National Council for Social Studies to produce a supplement that they have just added to their college, career, and civic life framework. This is what every state uses in order to determine their social studies curricula in their schools. So this is not only geography or political science, world history, but many other fields draw upon these frameworks, like people who are teaching literature and so on. So they also have included that statement in this new supplement that was just published this last month. There's another tool to help teachers promote religious literacy in schools, and that is to work with this definition of religion. One, religions are internally diverse as compared to uniform. Religions evolve and change over time, as opposed to being ahistoric or static. Religious influences are embedded in all dimensions of culture, as opposed to the assumptions that religions function in discrete or isolated private contexts. So this understanding of religions as being internally diverse, evolving and changing over time, and embedded is, I think, a very helpful way for courts even to legally define religion. As you'll see in just a moment, we take some of our students through the historic legal definitions of religion that have not been so generous. But there's another tool that we can use, and that is to look at how do people identify as religious? Why? What motivates them? So one of our faculty members, who is a full-time religious literacy specialist, he actually interviewed Catholics about their faith formation. And in that study, he started to see that simply the articulation of their beliefs didn't just result in certain behaviors, that their belonging to the Catholic Church was one part, but that didn't necessarily determine everything about their beliefs and behaviors because of the incredible amount of diversity within this massive Catholic Church. And so as he started to go deeper, he began to see that people began to identify their faith in different ways. For person A on your right, you'll see that their belief is the most important part of their identity, and that their behaviors, the certain practices that they might do, may be second to their participation in a community, or sort of acts of belonging. But for person B, that act of belonging, of being a part of that religious community, is foundational. And so that helped him kind of understand how two people who identify as Catholic attended church at different frequencies. For person B, it was of high frequency because it was of great importance. But for person C, the behaviors could be fundamental to their articulation of themselves as a person of faith. And so it's in this context that you see that individuals and their articulation of their identity is dynamic, just as religions at the macro sense are internally diverse, change over time, and are embedded in all aspects of culture. So one way that we have looked at this is we've worked with a scholar named Emil Lester, who went to Modesto, California to study the effects of a new curriculum that taught middle and high school students about world religions in public schools. And he surveyed the parents, he surveyed the students, the teachers, and he found that at the outset, students were alarmingly intolerant toward one another about religious difference, and were alarmingly illiterate about the First Amendment or religious liberties that were awarded to all. And they were illiterate about one another's religions and had lots of stereotypes about people's religions. In going through this curriculum, they found many different things, three of which I'll highlight here. One, the students' exposure to difference did not change the students' religious identities. right? That could be one of the greatest fears, right? If you teach them about other religions, will they leave the religion of their home? That was not the case, and there's an incredible testimony of an evangelical pastor whose daughter went through this program, and he said, you know, I was worried, but it actually reinforced her faith and led her to have a greater commitment. There is a positive impact on students' respect for religious liberty, especially for those with whom they previously disagreed. And they found that the parents and the teachers were beginning to see the schools as less as a battleground and more as a place to find common ground. So these are some of the attitudinal shifts and the political effects of being able to promote religious literacy in public schools. And so why is this religious literacy such a fundamental part of legal literacy? I have found in meeting people from all different types of walks of life who come to the museum that there's this one common trend, and that is when I meet with people from the American ACLU, for instance, and then people from the Catholic bishops and the Scientologists and Muslim Public Affairs Association and the Secular Coalition, and people from the Mormon Church and people from all different walks of life, American Alliance for Defending Freedom, and even some non-religious groups coming together, and one common thing keeps happening, and that is, as I hear them talk and I hear them give presentations at the museum, I hear them ultimately seeing themselves in the First Amendment. I see them as if they are looking up to those 45 words, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, and seeing a mirror, they see themselves reflected back. The great challenge of legal literacy is then being able to then turn from that mirror, look out into your sister's eyes, into your brother's face, into your country, and then see those freedoms upheld for others as well. That is how I understand religious liberty education. And so a pedagogy that we're developing for religious liberty education, which seems to be an emerging and exciting field, as you've heard from many scholars here, is that in telling the stories, in relearning these great human and civic lessons, one, we have to look at the lessons that had impact, their contemporary relevance, and be sure to include all the voices in that chorus who have cried out for liberty. So that means looking at both historic and contemporary, domestic and international issues, and making sure that everyone can see themselves in the curriculum, just like they see themselves in the First Amendment. And so some of the sample lessons in which we seek to cultivate that are examples of looking at the colonizing period of America, where in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, there were these great religious liberty battles. Many of you know, of course, the witch trials, for instance. So we take that very common narrative that many often learn in public schools, and we help public educators and religious leaders and journalists and business leaders grapple with these issues and say, what happened there? And then we show them a video of how 2,000 people have been accused of being witches and killed in northern parts of India from 2005 to 2011. So we take a historic event and we begin to see what was at play there in this mass hysteria. And how did the courts react? How did the people react? what led to this mass conflict and seeing it played out in contemporary terms today. We take an examination of Roger Williams' great contributions to religious liberty, including using biblical rationale not to establish a state religion. Talking about the wilderness of the world and the garden of the church being separate, and creating the first known government without an established religion, and how that, for the first time in colonial period, did not tie citizenship to a religious identity. But then we also begin to tell the stories of how he sought great, meaningful relationships with indigenous, how Rhode Island, 50 years after the start of this experiment, became the locus for the primary place for slave trade, not only of Africans to the new colonies, but also of the indigenous themselves being exported for slavery. So the story is simply, how is it that we can become what we set out against? In Pennsylvania, we see the great religious liberty conquest that William Penn had to face when he was expelled from Oxford University for refusing to be compelled to attend an Anglican worship service, and found refuge in the Quaker Church, where he became an esteemed leader. And it was out of that persecution that led him, when he was estated the land, what is now called Pennsylvania, to craft not only the Pennsylvania charters, but also that of New Jersey's, to proclaim the rights of conscience for people. Unfortunately, those rights had limitations. You had to have a belief in a future state of rewards or punishments in order to serve on a jury. So the Universalists, for instance, which is my tradition, who believed that God was too good to damn, that you're born of love and return to love, they were historically not allowed to serve on juries or to run for public office in Pennsylvania. In fact, this law was not overturned until the 1960s. I had a chance when I was serving as a minister in Pennsylvania to help with an amicus brief that helped overturn the blasphemy laws that were also pervasive in Pennsylvania, and that was in 2010. The stories of Virginia are ripe with conflict, where you see many different conflicts, where you see the imprisonment of Baptist preachers for preaching without a license. Even before then, you'll see that people had to attend church, obey the Sabbath. If not, they were publicly whipped. This is one of my favorite that I tell my congregation sometimes, and that is, if you say anything disrespectful to any minister, you would be whipped as well. That was colonial law. Yeah, that would be... Yes, I'm not advocating for this. that was in colonial Virginia. But it was because of these very harsh regulations of religion that it actually led to an ill-religious society, people moving away from it, even clergy not being able to actually be employed as a result of how poorly they were paid in tobacco and so on. And so it was actually through the repression, the state's repression of religion, that it created the climate that we begin to see in the revolutionary period, where religious liberty became this fundamental right in Virginia. And then that, of course, started to become an ethic that was used in the constitutional period, right? In Virginia, the Puritans in Massachusetts were barred from entering. The Catholics from Maryland were barred from Virginia to come if they had arms. There was a Papist Disarmament Act. And all these different conflicts between the many different Christianities that were internally diverse, that were changing over time, that were embedded in all aspects of culture, led to the political compromise of having no religious tests for office at the constitutional level. It was through the religious liberty rights guaranteed in Rhode Island that led many of them to protest a constitution that did not explicitly enumerate rights like liberty. And so it's in that context that you see the promise of James Madison to say, yes, if elected, I will come to the House and I will begin immediately to draft a Bill of Rights, which he did. And so in this context, we begin to see that there were two principles for one right: the principle of no establishment and the principle of free exercise of religion. These two principles make up one right, religious freedom. But we also begin to see that these articulations of liberty were unique and diverse in each state. By the time the Bill of Rights was constituted, 9 of the 14 then states had disestablished their religions. We begin to analyze why, what was happening, why in certain areas of this new fledging country would people choose to disestablish. It was often because of the internal diversity within the religions of that era. And then we begin to analyze the various different developments of religious liberty protections in the state constitutions. So in 1791, this first blue thin line, you begin to see how many states, the dotted black line at the top, there were at the country at the time. The dotted blue line articulates the states that then articulated having no public funds for religion. These were general no aid to religion laws. And it's such a fascinating inquiry into the motivations of each different state. Why Anglicans, who are a majority in one area, how Congregationalists in another area, how Lutherans in another area later in U.S. law, you begin to see they were motivated to make sure that public funds were not aiding religion or privileging one religion over another. Now, what's fascinating about this is you'll see if the dotted black line represents statehood, and then with that, of course, the westward expansion, and with that, of course, the extermination of many indigenous civilizations, you begin to see a new ethic emerging. One, there is the orange line, that's the rise of the no aid to religious education laws. They were primarily saying that the public will not fund theological education for seminarians. And in turn, that became for private schools. But at the same time, take a look at that green line. That is the data that shows when states adopted laws requiring students to attend schools, meaning compulsory education laws. I look at this and I see that the ethic of no establishment, the ethic of no aid to religion, were actually motivated by religious people for various different reasons. And this was an ethic long before even the ethic of public education. What you begin to see at the rise of the First World War is that there begins to be a uniformity in the laws at the local level, people using their state constitutions to articulate what becomes sort of what we know today on all these issues. During this latter part of the graph, you'll also see the Reconstruction laws with the 14th Amendment explicitly requiring that no state will deny anyone due process or equal protection under the law. And what's fascinating about this is that, in essence, these amendments, the 13th abolishing slavery, the 14th, and so on, they made clear that the U.S. Constitution was the supreme law of the land, like one of our speakers mentioned, but that there are some duties which are not enumerated that are
Thank
then
you all
rewarded
very much.
For the states.
So it, unfortunately, it so often seems that it is split into camps,
it's
right?
God.
The religious freedom camp, you could say, versus the LGBTQ rights
I should mime
activism
it.
Camp. And although that's not what we want, it so often is framed that way. And just to give an example of that, I posted about being at this conference. And one of my friends, who would find himself much less in the religious freedom camp and much more in the LGBT rights camp, commented asking why I felt there was any attack to religious freedom. Why am I making up this narrative of attacks on religious freedom? And I want to use that as a basis for my question, because I know on the other side, a lot of people in the religious freedom camp might not be very aware that there are really significant attacks or difficulties being faced by people in the LGBTQ activism camp. So my question is, how would you explain to someone, for the purpose of this discussion, in the religious freedom camp, why they should fight for LGBTQ rights, equality, etc.? And how would you explain to somebody in the other camp why they should fight for religious freedom?
All right. No problem at all. Good job, tech people. Thanks for solving that. Out of the Reconstruction period, you begin to see the incorporation of sections diversity. Of the First Amendment to the states. So the Freedom of Speech Clause being incorporated to the states in 1925 through a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And then again with press in 31, assembly in 37, religion in 40, and then disestablishment in 47, and petition. Such an underrepresented first freedom in 1963. Yes, thank you.
And I'm trying to give everyone two for the price of one.
Yeah, there's so much wisdom to share. So, no worries. What I find fascinating about this era is, and this is one of the under-researched areas, I think, in religious liberty education, is the intersection of race and religion. So from the time the Bill of Rights was incorporated, so 1791, until Kennedy's administration, 1965, there was one requirement in order to become a citizen, and that was you had to be white. These laws were challenged several times. The first, one of which was in 1922, when Mr. Ozawa was denied citizenship on the grounds that Japanese were not considered white. In this unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court denied his citizenship and later used that ruling in order to help justify the internment of Japanese. Another case that came before the court was that of Bhagat Singh Thind, an Indian Sikh who came before the Supreme Court and said, "I'm actually from the Caucasus of India, and therefore I come from the place where the term Caucasian came from." I can imagine him saying, "And I'm more white than you." And he said, "But don't take the science at face value. Take my patriotism. I served in World War I, and I have proven myself to be worthy." Again, the U.S. denied his citizenship. What we see as a result of these laws of requiring citizens to, requiring somebody to be white in order to gain citizenship from the Bill of Rights until 1965, is a legal construction of race that fundamentally harnessed religious liberty in the United States. It created the holding ground for the vast expansion of the various Christianities. There are apparently 4,100 different types of Christianities. But many people from other areas of the world who practice different religions were denied access to this country because of their race. And so it created a social construct that was fundamentally changed in 1965, and then because of that change, you begin to see the demographics change, and that's why you see, in part, why in 2012 Protestants for the first time became a minority. So the legal construction of race has a direct tie, I see, to the questions of religious liberty. Of course, it was during this era that you begin to see the articulation of human rights. And of course, this was born out of direct persecution of the 6 million Jews who were exterminated. So it was out of religious persecution that the human rights era was born. The very articulation that everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his or her religion and freedom either alone or in community with others and in public or private to manifest his or her religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. This is a profound articulation of dignity across cultures. What's fascinating about this is that in our human rights classes, we articulate many different ways that religions have advocated for human rights. What are the theological underpinnings of rights across traditions around the world? And another way to do this human rights education came as a result of a conference that Cole, Brett, and others organized in Oxford this last year, which was actually a profound experience and really benefited me as a person and as an educator. And that was to look at four different ways that human rights are understood around the world as it relates to religion. Freedom of religion is something we often talk about. Freedom for religion, to have certain accommodations or protections. Freedom from religion, as one indigenous woman from South Africa articulated that she wanted freedom from the majority religion to determine her own. Freedom within religion, the much diversity within religion to be able to evolve and change as the religious communities decide. And so these are just four of the ways that that different rule of law approaches are being used around the world, which goes back to why I think these types of approaches should be taught in public schools to help future citizens, voters, future leaders, as well as the educators and parents themselves, to see the locus of the public school as a place for common ground work, where leaders and learners can be literate about not only religion, but the law, and respond to that ever-changing landscape. And in doing so, they may be able to seek mutual understanding and move beyond the zero-sum game where one person's win is another person's loss. It's an honor to be in your presence. Thank you for your time and kind attention.